And if you want to reserve time, please watch the clock.
I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Good morning. Brenna Scully for the United States. May it please the court. The state panel correctly held that plaintiffs are not likely to succeed on the merits of their Fifth Amendment substantive due process claim because their proposed fundamental right to be free from the incidental effects of airborne contaminants is not deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. The state panel also correctly determined that the balance of the equities and the public interest favor the government. For those exact same reasons, the court should now vacate the preliminary injunction in full. Plaintiffs have not presented anything new that would alter that conclusion. The key points are these, as they were before the state panel. The district court prospectively prohibited federal agents from using an entire class of defensive law enforcement tools that are commonly used and have been used for decades to disperse protesters outside a federal detention facility. The district court based that injunction on a new fundamental right that the court noted had never been recognized before, of a substantive due process right to be free from the incidental effects of airborne contaminants.
Can you address, they have a slightly new argument. They say now substantive due process, we should look at shock the conscience standard as opposed to fundamental rights. Can you address that?
Sure. So my very short answer is I would direct the court to County of Sacramento versus Lewis, footnote 8. There, the Supreme Court made quite clear that for substantive due process claims challenging executive action, plaintiffs must satisfy two elements, one of which is shocks the conscience, and the other is that the challenged executive action implicates a fundamental right. This court correctly applied that standard in Britton versus Hansen.
Did Justice Scalia, though, in his concurrence in that case, view it that way, that Lewis, footnote 8, established a conjunctive test?
That's right, Your Honor. And in response to Justice Scalia's concurrence, the majority wrote footnote 8. And there the court said that Justice Scalia was simply mistaken, I'm quoting, in seeing our insistence on the shocks of conscience standard as an atavistic return to a scheme of due process analysis rejected by Glucksberg. And I think there the court is making clear that Glucksberg is the correct analysis to determine if the challenged executive conduct implicates a fundamental right. And of course, in Lewis, the court had no occasion to reach that question because the challenged conduct did not shock the conscience. But that doesn't mean that the second element is not necessary, as this court recognized in Britton versus Hansen.
Counsel, in Obergefell versus Hodges, the Supreme Court noted they took a wider approach than Glucksberg did for the fundamental elements test. Why don't we do that here?
Because I think that Obergefell made quite clear that, I believe the analysis that Your Honor is referring to was a discussion about the fundamental right to marriage. Mm-hmm. And there what the court was explaining is that in analyzing that fundamental right, courts had not limited it to the particular traits of each individual spouse or would-be spouse. And I think that's the key point, is that for that particular fundamental right, that there is no history or tradition of limiting it to particular characteristics of the spouses. But Obergefell made that analysis quite limited to the fundamental right of marriage and is silent as to the Glucksberg analysis for other rights. And to the extent that Your Honor is not quite sure about after Obergefell, I would say look to Dobbs, where the Supreme Court made very clear that Glucksberg applies and the carefully defined right and the deeply rooted requirement in history and tradition applies to all purported fundamental rights, and that analysis must be followed.
Well, what do we talk about? Like, what do we do with cases like Riggins, where they talked about the injection of unwanted chemicals into the body? That's not allowed, right? I mean, I find that it's not quite as tight of an argument as you're making. The Supreme Court has said we have a right to bodily integrity. I walk me through why these other cases don't support that.
So I think that when this abstract concept of bodily integrity doesn't actually get us very far. And when we look at cases like Riggins, and I would direct the court to the Supreme Court's discussion in Glucksberg about Riggins, and that what's really happening there is there's a much more narrowly defined right to be free from unwanted medical procedures, stomach pumping in that case. And how Glucksberg describes it is that the carefully defined nature of that right, which was the right to be free from forcible stomach pumping, which the court analogized to non-consensual medical treatment, that is deeply rooted in Anglo-American common law. And so that right is a fundamental right recognized under the Substantive Due Process Clause. And the reason that Riggins doesn't really help us here is because we have to carefully define the right in this case. And so abstracting to a general concept like bodily integrity just doesn't actually get us very far in the substantive due process analysis. And to really underscore that point, I would direct the court to Raich versus Gonzalez, this court's holding, where the plaintiff said that she had a fundamental right of bodily integrity, and the court said, well, the key point that plaintiff was advancing was a right to use marijuana to protect the right to bodily integrity. And so again, we see the court clarifying whatever the proposed right is with respect to the particular factual allegations brought by the plaintiff. And I think that the court needs to do that here and carefully define the right, and then, as a stay panel correctly held, base that careful definition in a history and tradition analysis.
Counsel, what do we do about language in our court's precedents that seem to treat the shocks to conscience test as its own element? So your friend on the other side cites several cases to that effect. What do we make of that?
So I would direct the court to pages 21 and 22 of our reply brief where we go through those cases, but I'm happy to explain them further here. So let's start with Regino versus Staley. So first of all, that's not an executive action case. There, the plaintiff was raising an as-applied and facial challenges to a school policy. And so that's actually a completely different set of substantive due process claims, as plaintiff counsel point out. There's the sort of legislative enactment, which we get strict scrutiny, rational basis review, and then there's executive action. So Regina versus Staley didn't actually have to apply the shocks of conscience test because of the nature of the claim. But that's that case aside. As we explain in our brief, in some of the cases that plaintiffs cite for sort of a one-line proposition, what the court actually did in those cases, some of them was say, there's no fundamental right, and did not actually consider shocks of conscience. And then we've sort of bucketed a third category of cases where it appears that plaintiffs did allege a fundamental right. So just for example, was a loss of familial relationship would be one. And the court focused on substantive due process. From our read of the cases, it doesn't really appear that the fundamental right allegations were disputed. And so really the point as to those cases is they don't really provide much help in this area. And so when you have Lewis footnote 8, which quite clearly directs courts, as this court applied in Britain versus Hansen, to do a two-part analysis, those cases don't really move the needle away from those key
points. Are you just trying to distinguish them or saying they don't establish a disjunctive test, shock the conscience, fundamental rights? Or are you saying they might, but, you know, even though we typically have to follow our own precedent, you have Lewis footnote 8, Supreme Court, and we have to follow the Supreme Court?
I guess what I'm saying, Your Honor, is both. The first point you made is our primary argument, that this court has not recognized a disjunctive test, has not ever applied, I guess would be our argument, the disjunctive test. My second argument is to the extent that the court is uncomfortable with that position, our second argument is that this court has never made clear that there is a disjunctive test. And when we compare that with Britain, which says it's a two-element test, and when we compare that with Lewis, those precedents should control, given the lack of clarity in the cases cited by plaintiff's counsel.
Do you win under either standard?
Yes, Your Honor.
Tell me why you went under shocks of conscience.
So shocks of conscience, as we explain in our brief, is measured by two different standards depending on the nature of the allegations. And so plaintiffs have advanced deliberate indifference test. The government obviously has advanced the purpose to harm test. And the district court and plaintiffs before this court have focused on whether there was literally enough time to deliberate. And that's just not the right test for determining which standard applies. I would direct the court to Whitley versus Alber and again to Lewis, where the court said, you know, we're not really looking at whether or not there was literally time or how much time, and we're not going to measure a constitutional standard in terms of minutes. The real test is whether the government was required to balance competing public safety interests. And to really illustrate why purpose to harm is the right standard, I'd like to focus on how plaintiffs have conceived of deliberate indifference. So as plaintiffs have presented this, deliberate indifference is when the government is aware that an action poses a risk of harm to a particular group of people and does the thing anyways. But governments do that all the time when they're balancing competing public safety interests. For example, when the government effectuates an arrest, maybe the government is preparing for that for weeks or days, and the government has to consider the public safety benefits from conducting the arrest, and of course, the potential risk of harm to officers, to the suspect, to people nearby. But when the government decides to conduct that arrest, it doesn't shock the conscience. I mean, the plaintiff's point is to no case holding that that type of balancing of competing public safety interests, which the government does all the time, as the court recognized in Whitley versus Alpers and in County of Sacramento versus Lewis, that that type of conduct is deliberately indifferent and therefore shocks the conscience. I mean, that would really work a sea change in how substantive due process works. And I just don't see any authority from the district court or in plaintiff's briefs showing that the deliberate indifference standard is the correct measure here. And so based on Whitley versus Albers and Lewis, the purpose to harm standard applies, and the district court made no findings that officers here, the government, acted with purpose to harm, and neither of plaintiffs really made that allegation.
Counsel, I have a question that's kind of I'm going to make you pivot. I had a question about the social media influencers. Were they there? Were they there with the ICE agents during these protests?
So I would direct the court to the district court's findings on that point. And
what were those findings?
I believe the district court said that there were social media influencers present on several occasions. I don't have any more information for the court on that point.
I still have questions. So they were present. My understanding of reading everything is they were present with the ICE agents, like on that side of it, not as like the protesters kind of looking at the ICE agents. They were more from the angle that the ICE agents had. I ask because I'm concerned about if the ICE agents were so concerned for their safety, why would they allow people to be on their side? I don't know if my question's making sense. It's, you know, if I'm a police officer, I'm not going to let somebody ride along if I think I'm going to go into some dangerous mission. I'm confused. So explain to me what.
So as to the factual point, Your Honor, again, I would direct you to the district court's finding. I don't have any additional information as to the facts. Taking the sort of situation, as Your Honor has posited, as sort of a hypothetical, assuming those facts to be true, what I would say about that situation is, one, that the preliminary injunction doesn't just prohibit the use of chemical irritants in those circumstances. It prohibits them much broader. So at the very basis, the injunction is still improper and should be vacated. As to the more substantive analysis of the substantive due process right on the merits, what I would say there is that still doesn't alter the fact that plaintiffs would fail to allege a fundamental right. And so the only question that Your Honor's hypothetical goes to is whether the shocks of conscience standard and which standard we look to. And I would say that in a particular situation where the government is deciding how best to confront a public safety concern, and maybe to Your Honor's point, I mean, the degree of danger involved, that's a determination left to the officers on the scene based on the particular facts and circumstances that they face. I would still say that in that situation, if officers have to balance the risk of harm to civilians who are on government property, to the officers, that is still the type of balancing decision that I think would require analysis of the purpose to harm standard, regardless of sort of a retrospective evaluation of the degree of risk involved.
On a related point, can you address this? Plaintiffs suggest in the briefs that some of the tear gas was used solely for social media purposes, to have clips on social media. Can you address that? I mean, if the allegation is true, that's probably the more troubling ones.
Sure, Your Honor. So my answer is the same that I gave the stay panel when I was here last, which is the district court did not find that chemical irritants were dispersed for the sole purpose of creating social media videos.
Did it address one way or the other, or just was silent on it?
From my reading of the district court's opinion, the district court described the allegations brought by that have been raised by plaintiffs. That's how I read the opinion.
I'm sorry, say that again. They described it?
As I read the district court's opinion, the district court prefaces those sentences as plaintiffs have alleged.
So they didn't find either way?
That's my reading of the district court opinion, Your Honor, yes.
And you don't have any independent knowledge of that through your client?
No, I don't have any independent knowledge, and I will note that since the court stayed district court proceedings, there's been no discovery or additional factual findings since I was here last.
Counsel, you raised a standing argument here. I don't think you raised the standing argument before the stay panel, although jurisdiction is not waivable, so we still have to address it, I think. But in this preliminary injunction posture, if we find the standing question, let's say, more thorny, can we look to the merits and say there's no likelihood of success on the merits and dispose of the PI that way, assuming we're going to go that way, and not touch the standing issue? Is that a permissible avenue here?
Yes, Your Honor. I would direct the court to the Supreme Court's decision a couple weeks ago in Mullen versus Doe. There, the plurality opinion made that point expressly, and two other justices joined the discussion of the merits. So I think that there's sufficient support for the court to do so, and the government would be fine if the court decided that plaintiffs have failed to establish likelihood of success on their substantive due process claim. I see I'm at time, so if the court has no further questions.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Stephen Wirth for the plaintiffs. May it please the court. The Fifth Amendment constrains the executive branch from engaging in conscience-shocking conduct. That's what's at stake here. The government has knowingly and repeatedly caused toxic chemicals to enter the bodies and homes of innocent people, causing them irreparable and life-altering harms.
Counsel, let me interrupt you and just jump right in. What standards should we look to? Do we need to have both the fundamental and the shocks of conscience, or is it just one? And if it's both, do you win under both?
So the standard is set forth in Lewis. Lewis makes very clear that in cases involving executive conduct, that the shocks the conscience standard is what applies. And that's what the whole dispute between Justice Scalia and the majority was about. So, yes. The standard is shocks the conscience. The fundamental rights test is a separate test. It's a test for discovering new, as yet undefined, fundamental rights. This case is not about a new, undefined fundamental right. It is a shocks the conscience test. That said, you know, we've set out very clearly in our papers that we can survive under both tests. So that's partly because in Glucksberg itself, the Supreme Court recognized the right to bodily integrity as one of the very few pre-existing rights, fundamental rights, under the Fifth Amendment. So I would say that you know, both exist, and this court expressly held in Regino, and I do want to make this very clear. Ms. Scully said that this court has never applied the two tests, but I will point the court to footnote 5, which says unmistakably that there are two tests, and it lays it out in the disjunctive, and it says that they are different, and it makes clear that the court was applying only the fundamental rights test.
Counsel, but how do you explain Brittain versus Hansen, which says it is not enough to allege conscience-shocking action?
That's right.
Brittain must show both a deprivation of her liberty and conscience-shocking behavior by the government.
Absolutely, Judge Sung, and I completely adopt that standard. The deprivation of liberty is required, and we've shown a deprivation of liberty. That's required under the Fifth Amendment, which protects deprivations of life, liberty, and property. But that's different from a fundamental right style analysis that's set out in Glucksberg. And I think if you read the Brittain opinion, that shows exactly how this is supposed to work. You have to identify a liberty interest, which we have, the liberty interest in bodily integrity, and then you do a conscience-shocking analysis. I think the difference is, and this is what is not present in Brittain, is Glucksberg goes into a deep analysis of history and tradition and the legal tradition, et cetera. It goes back to the common law. There's nothing like that in Brittain. I think that's really telling because Brittain is a shocks the conscience test. And I think beyond Brittain, you know, we also have, again, Regino says this very clearly, but we also have decades of application in case after case after case, post-Glucksberg, in which this court has gone through a shocks the conscience analysis, and it has never required, on top of that, a Glucksberg fundamental rights analysis. So I'd point the court to Estate of Sokai against Abdelaziz. I'd point the court to Vasquez. Vasquez was sexual harassment. There was no analysis of whether there's a fundamental right not to be sexually harassed by a prison guard.
If there's no analysis, doesn't that mean they didn't address it? Whether or not whether we should apply a fundamental rights analysis per Glucksberg?
Well, certainly they didn't address it, and I agree they didn't address it, but that's because it's not required, because there are two tests, because that's what Lewis says, that's what Regino says. There's just no question that the test is shocks the conscience. And so the fact that it wasn't addressed is the evidence that we have that it is not a mandatory requirement. So, you know, I pointed the court to Abdelaziz, to Vasquez. I'd also point the court to Nicholson. I think this is a critical case in part because it also was a deliberate indifference case. It involved It is very similar. I'm sorry. It is a case where a bystander was injured by a police shooting. The court didn't apply the intent to harm standard. It applied a deliberate indifference standard. And on top of all of that, the court didn't engage in any sort of Glucksberg analysis whatsoever.
Can you have conduct that constitutes that would shock the conscience but not implicate fundamental rights?
I think you could potentially see that. I think you could see that, for example, in Vasquez. Vasquez was a sexual harassment case. The allegations there, you know, troubling, absolutely troubling, but certainly of the sort that a court could say could be handled in tort, because sexual harassment is also a tort. So there's an example.
But I mean, if you do that, I mean, the case law here is, I think, just muddled and a little bit confused. I mean, if we use that standard, couldn't, you know, Dobbs says there's no fundamental right to abortion, but couldn't someone try to do an end run around it and say it shocks the conscience for the government to compel a woman to carry a baby for 9 months and give birth and be legally responsible for it? I mean, that kind of end run around it?
I don't think that is a problem, and I think that's precisely...
The end run isn't a problem?
No, I don't think the end run is a problem. I think precisely because of the sort of dichotomy that Lewis sets out. So if, you know, all of these abortion restrictions are being done through legislation or regulation, and that's an instance where you require fundamental rights, because the process that is due in legislation and regulation type cases is the process of the legislative enactment. And so we require a heightened standard in order to determine whether that legislative enactment is subject to strict scrutiny or rational basis. That's the whole framework, and that's why the shocks the conscience standard and the fundamental rights standards are just sort of, they're different approaches, because the nature of the government conduct is so different. Executive action, especially executive action by law enforcement, is simply a different type of governmental act from legislation.
So suppose a public school teacher tells a student, I'm going to fail you because I don't like you. Which is clearly arbitrary. So would that kind of conduct shock the conscience?
No, I don't know that it would. Certainly it would be disturbing, but it's nothing like the cases involving conscience-shocking behavior that I've recounted. Certainly nothing like the allegations that we have here of really grievous bodily harm. So no, I don't think that even a sort of arbitrary governmental act like that likely would not shock the conscience. Of course, the court could go into an analysis, but I don't even know that there would be a liberty interest that was implicated in a fair grading procedure. Again, I think this is just a completely, it's so different from the conscience-shocking behavior that we see in all of these cases. I don't think it would cross that very low bar.
Counsel, is it your position that any use of tear gas shocks the conscience?
No, absolutely not.
So how much is too much? When does it become shocking the conscience?
So I think that the district court's analysis here is very useful. The district court saw all the evidence of what was going on here on the scene, reviewed the policies, reviewed all the statements from law enforcement officers, reviewed all the video evidence, reviewed all the testimony, and the court found that that in these circumstances, it is conscience shocking for the government to deploy massive quantities of tear gas that is likely to invade the homes and bodies of plaintiffs who are immediately next door.
You don't need a massive amount in order for something to waft over, potentially, right? It depends on several environmental factors. Massive is an ambiguous term. Is there a way to quantify that, and likelihood of the gas going over there doesn't necessarily depend on the amounts per se?
So what the court said is it spoke in terms of likelihood, and the court also noted that the government is well aware of how these substances work and is able to modify its conduct in order to achieve law enforcement aims while not invading the homes and bodies of plaintiffs. And the district court made comprehensive findings about the nature of these substances and the nature of the government's knowledge about how they act. And so imposing a likelihood requirement on the government is totally reasonable under those circumstances on this factual record.
Under the shock, the conscience standard, the government says we should apply a purpose to harm standard, and you argue should be deliberate indifference. Can you elaborate further on why you think we should apply a deliberate indifference standard here?
Absolutely. I think there's several things to say. First, I want to mention sort of the government's proposed standard about balancing harms is simply not a standard that this court has ever adopted, and I would in particular point the court to the Nicholson case, which again, it was a fast-moving incident where a police officer believed that he saw a person with a gun, thought that there was danger, obviously, because a gun was involved, chased after the suspects and ended up shooting two people, one person who was carrying I think it was a toy gun, and another person who was nearby. And there, this court applied a deliberate indifference standard. And so I think that's sort of a perfect example. But here, I think there's a variety of facts that are relevant to why the deliberate indifference standard applies. One is the overwhelming amount of knowledge here that the defendants were aware that their conduct was causing really extreme harms. Two is that they had other methods to sort of mitigate. They have other crowd control devices. They could engage in different tactics. They didn't do that. They continued to engage in just massive, massive quantities of tear gas right outside of a residential area. They knew that these gases in particular were really harmful. They received training on just how harmful they are, and they had direct knowledge about the real harms to our plaintiffs in the form of the declarations that were already in the record when they engaged in much of this conduct. Again, much of the conduct that we're challenging here occurred after we filed our lawsuit, after we filed our motion for a preliminary injunction. We're talking about numerous occasions over the course of, I believe it was 8 days, 10 different huge gassing events over 8 days. And in particular, I'd point the court to all of the exhibits that we put in the record, the video evidence we cited in our brief, but in particular, I hope that the court will actually view exhibits 1 and 2 and 18 and 19 and 44 through 47 and 49 and 54 through 57. All of these videos show just the huge amounts of gas that were being used. The district court had all of this evidence in front of it, and it was right to conclude that on that evidence, you know, this was a degree of deliberate indifference. I think,
but the context here is if there's nobody in the streets and they were just deploying tear gas, it'd be one thing. But here we also have a record of massive protests over a course of a year, over 150 protests, violations of law, projectiles being thrown. So you have to take that into context and with the government's response.
Absolutely. But I would say that so much of the government's justification here was the protection of federal property from vandalism. And balanced against the types of harms that are in this record, I just don't think that the comparison is even remotely appropriate. The government can do all manner of things to protect government property. It can put up barriers. It can arrest people. In this case, I think the government could even use pepper spray and pepper balls in a degree that would keep people away from federal property, that would clear the driveway. And what we're talking about is something completely different. And we know that the government has had actual time to deliberate here because it occurred over months and months, because the government has responded to the same fact patterns over and over tactics.
I know you mentioned a lot about plans, but I mean, it's one thing to have a plan in the abstract and see what happens in reality. And I'm reminded of that famous Mike Tyson quote, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Provocative, maybe crass quote, but a little bit, I mean, they do have plans, but when mass unrest occurs, it's kind of a different situation. And should we be second guessing what law enforcement does in that type of situation?
I think on the evidence here, absolutely, it was appropriate for the government, for the court to enjoin this type of conduct. Again, we're talking about recurring incidents where a protester steps a foot over a line, or is blocking a driveway, or where there's an attempt to leave or enter the ICE facility. We're not talking about extremely dangerous circumstances, certainly not in every case. And the court was right to find that on numerous occasions, corroborated by video, the government deployed massive amounts of tear gas in response to zero threat whatsoever. There's video of ICE officers leaving the facility, walking into a crowd of protesters, and immediately deploying huge amounts of tear gas for no reason. Again, the district court was right to make all of those findings based on the evidence that was before the district court. And Ms. Scully is not disputing those findings as clearly erroneous whatsoever. So we have an ample record to find not only that the government had time to deliberate, but they did so, and that they were deliberately indifferent to these plaintiffs' serious harms.
Counsel, is there anything new in the record before us on appeal that wasn't before us at the state level?
No.
Okay. So the only thing different is not factual, but potentially this legal argument that the test is disjunctive and not conjunctive.
So I wouldn't describe that as new. I think from the very beginning of this case and throughout, the way that we framed it is, and you can sort of trace this through our briefing, is that plaintiffs need to identify a liberty interest, which we have, and conduct that shocks the conscience. That's been our framing from the beginning. We've resisted the Glucksberg history and tradition analysis from day one. We've never adopted it as our own framework for
the district
case.
Court applied the Glucksberg test, though,
it
right?
It did. The district court
determining whether there was a liberty interest.
That's right. The district court agreed with the government's framing to some degree, and still ruled against the government. And again, we
did
in the alternative
to that framing, though, in district court.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did you object to the government's framing and the district court's acceptance of that framing in district court?
We didn't object in the sense that, I guess what I would say is that we framed it differently and we insisted on a different framing. We resisted the government's Glucksberg analysis from the beginning. We did, in the alternative, as we have argued in the alternative here, say that this is the right to bodily integrity here is well established, that we can trace our particular plaintiff's right to bodily integrity to cases like Riggins, which wasn't a stomach pumping case. That's the case with, I believe it was injection of chemicals into the body that the court found was a violation of, the Supreme Court found was a violation of the right to bodily integrity. Again, that's how we frame things as two different approaches, and I do think that we do win under both.
Counsel, I have a bit of trouble with your reading of Lewis, and let's focus on that footnote.
I'd be happy to.
The notorious footnote 8. Here, it says the case presents an issue antecedent to any question about the need for historical examples of enforcing a liberty interest. Then it says, in a due process challenge to executive action, the threshold question is whether the behavior of the governmental officer is so egregious. Only if the necessary condition of egregious behavior were satisfied would there be a possibility of recognizing a substantive due process right to be free of such executive action. And only then might there be a debate about the sufficiency of historical examples. And again, it says, in an executive action case, no such issue can arise if the conduct does not reach the degree of the egregious. So the words antecedent, threshold, the phrase only if necessary seems to very clearly set up a conjunctive test that you need both. I'm having trouble with your opposing view here. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. So I do think that there is a sort of plausible reading here that Lewis at least left open that question, but certainly it doesn't set it up as a conjunctive test. And again, the whole dispute with Justice Scalia really doesn't make sense at all if this is a conjunctive test. I think in particular, though, you can see right in the footnote itself, one, it describes Glucksberg as being a test about state legislation. That's in the second paragraph of the footnote. And I think in particular, then the court goes on to say, well, you know, it might give rise to a question about historical precedents. It may then be possible to look at history in order to determine whether a right is established. But since that time, and I think this is critical, since that time, the Supreme Court's never applied Lewis's footnote to establish a conjunctive test that requires both conscious shocking behavior and a new rights analysis under Glucksberg. And since that time, this court has never applied the tests in the conjunctive. And since that time, just last year in Regino, this court said in the footnote very clearly there's two disjunctive tests. This court, of course, is bound by other three-judge panels' descriptions and of the legal standard at issue. So I think that really is sort of case closed. But if there were any question at all, I would commend to Your Honors Judge Timkovich's description of how this all works together. I think his analysis is really sensitive and correct.
There was another 10th Circuit judge at the time, then Judge Gorsuch, who said that this executive action test actually is more difficult to satisfy than just a challenge to legislative action,
which suggests
a conjunctive test.
I don't think that that does suggest a conjunctive test. I think that that actually does recognize that the standard for conscience-shocking action is quite high, right? There's no question that to shock the conscience, I mean, that is one of the highest standards in the law, but it is a functionally different analysis than establishing a new right under Glucksberg. And I think that makes sense in particular because executive action can take many forms that are unprecedented and unknown and can give rise to harms that had not yet been suffered. And so that can still shock the conscience, which is a very high standard, even if there isn't first a very narrowly defined right in the Glucksberg sense that could be established under law for determining whether strict scrutiny or rational basis should apply.
One last question, counsel. I know shocks of conscience is used in the case law, as you point out in your briefing and here, but how do we prevent this test from being used as a means of judicial policymaking, of freewheeling judicial policymaking that our substantive due process precedents have cautioned against?
Absolutely, Judge Tung. And I think this also goes to something that you wrote in the stay opinion, which concerned making the Constitution into a font of tort law or into a NIMBY charter. I don't think that that is a problem here, or that there's a problem of judicial policymaking, because conscience shocking behavior here is really an extremely high standard, and so it does prevent. That is what is doing the constraining. It was what was doing the constraining in Lewis itself. It's what's doing the constraining in all of this court's precedents. A conscience-shocking standard is a high one, but it is easily satisfied here. This is simply conscience-shocking government conduct.
If we disagree with you, do you still win?
Absolutely. We still win under sort of a Glucksberg analysis. I think we also... I think ultimately the court does need to address whether, in order for us to prevail, the court does need to address whether there's been a Fifth Amendment substantive due process violation, which does go through the conscience-shocking framework. So I think that is necessary.
Counsel, if we disagree with you on the likelihood of success prong of the Winter test, do we need to address the equitable factors, or do you lose on prong one?
You do need to address all of the factors. And seeing no further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, can I pick up where I ended with your friend on the other side? If we find for the government on prong one of the Winter test, do we even need to address the other equitable factors?
I think the court does, and as the state panel correctly determined, the balance of equities and the public interest favor the government. So I really think the focus of this case is the merits. I would direct the court to our briefing on those other factors. I do on the merits. I think we should take a step back. As the court has pointed out, this area of case law is a muddle. And I think we take a step back and start with Dobbs, the Supreme Court's most recent merits opinion on substantive due process. And Dobbs makes clear that substantive due process is interpreting the word liberty in the Fifth Amendment. And the word liberty has to be defined by Glucksberg's fundamental rights analysis. Otherwise, this sort of non-fundamental liberty interest that plaintiffs posit, that's more of like a procedural due process liberty interest. I would direct the court to page 967 of the Regino opinion, where the court explained that substantive due process deals with questions of fundamental rights, and procedural due process deals with still liberty interests, but liberty interests that can be defined by state law, not just fundamental rights. And really what plaintiff's position comes down to in this case is A very expansive reading of an abstract concept of bodily integrity that looks a lot like battery, like when the government physically injures somebody. And plaintiff's conception of deliberate indifference is when the government is aware that an action may pose a risk of injury to a group of people. That's a tort claim. That's a mens rea of recklessness or knowing and physical harm. And the Supreme Court has made quite clear that tort claims are not substantive due process violations. And so as we sort of get lost in this muddle of does Britain control, does Regino control, you know, we obviously agree with the reading of Lewis footnote 8 that says it's a two-part test. But, like, I think that there is just a more fundamental issue in this case, which is what does, like, the word liberty mean, and does it mean any sort of harm taken when the government, I mean, the hypothetical I gave to the court when I was up here last about the government making lots of decisions that risk harm to people, but the government determines that the public safety benefit outweighs that risk. And does every time that decision happens implicate substantive due process? Because that seems a lot like freewheeling judicial policymaking that Dobbs made quite clear is not a substantive due process claim.
Counsel, let me ask you a question that is based on an argument that opposing counsel made, which is that the liberty interest, when we evaluate what the liberty interest is in executive action cases, looks different from the liberty interest analysis when we're looking to legislative action. So you've got this two-tiered analysis. What do you make of that argument?
I don't see any authority for that proposition. Again, I would direct the court to page 967 of Regino, where the court explained that substantive due process claims, and I don't see any basis for, on this particular point, distinguishing between executive action and legislative enactment cases, but substantive due process looks at fundamental rights. Procedural due process looks at liberty interests at a broader level.
I find that argument somewhat persuasive, counsel, but doesn't that run into problems with your primary incidental effects argument where you rely on O'Bannon? Because O'Bannon there, that was a procedural due process case, and you're using that case to analogize to our substantive due process case. But now, when your response to me just now, you seem to reject that maneuver.
No, so our reliance on O'Bannon is more that, is there a deprivation at all? And so our point there is, like, when the government takes a particular action against a third party, and as a result of that action, others are harmed, that's not a deprivation that rises to the level of a due process harm, whether or not it's procedural or substantive. I would direct the court to our briefs where we explain that both types of claims require a deprivation. So it's sort of, we're just analyzing sort of a different term. Going back to your prior question, I would direct the court again to Lewis footnote 8, where the Supreme Court wrote, executive action challenges raise a particular need to preserve the constitutional proportions of constitutional claims, lest the Constitution be demoted to what we have called a font of tort law. And so to the extent that this court is concerned about differences between executive action and legislative enactment cases, I think the Supreme Court there is telling us that we need to be very careful in this area for the reasons that I've explained about expanding substantive due process to become tort claims. We think the stay panel got this right. And for the reasons that we've discussed this morning, these new arguments don't change that conclusion that plaintiffs have not shown a likelihood of success on their substantive due process claim. And so we would, unless the court has further questions, we would urge the court to vacate the injunction in full. Thank you.
Great. Yeah. Thank you both for the helpful argument. The case is submitted.